We're remembering NASA's Opportunity rover and looking at what comes next for exploring Mars. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In more than 14 years of roaming the Red Planet, the Opportunity rover took more than 210,000 pictures. Because of Opportunity, scientists were able to unlock some of the geological history of Mars. What questions do you have about Opportunity's contributions to Mars research? Do you remember NASA launching this rover? And what do you want to see happen next for exploring Mars? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Berger is senior space editor at the technology news website Ars Technica. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on, Kate.
Well, against all expectations, Opportunity became the longest-lasting robotic explorer ever sent to another planet. How big of a deal was that little rover that could?
It was quite a big deal. As you may recall, it landed back on Mars in 2004, and before that, only one other rover had ever been sent to another planet. Not counting the moon is not a planet, but before that, only Sojourner had been sent to Mars back in 1996, and that was really a tiny rover that lasted for 84 days. And so, to have something go to Mars and survive for 15 years really was a pretty stupendous achievement.
Do we have any sense as to how Opportunity was able to last as long as it did?
Well, you know, when the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California designs its spacecraft, it has minimum specifications. But it always, you know, hopes to double or triple that lifetime by building in components that can last longer. And in this case, you know, there was no internal power source that was going to run out of fuel, things like that. And so as it ran on solar power, you know, they got lucky and it lasted a long time.
Yeah, so solar power really helped it last, and solar power that even in the early 2000s seemed to be advanced enough to make this rover work for quite a while.
Yeah, in these rovers you'll often find much better batteries, computers, and more efficient solar panels that you can buy commercially because, you know, when you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to build a spacecraft, you're going to put in the best sort of components you can. Typically, you don't see off-the-shelf materials.
So what did Opportunity in? What happened to it?
Well, last summer, this global dust storm kicked up over Mars, one of the worst that we've ever seen on the Red Planet. And Opportunity happened to be in a place where it was really exposed to this. And, you know, dust the efficiency of his solar panels had gone down somewhat. In this case, a lot of dust settled on Opportunity, and it basically didn't have enough power to operate. And so scientists back here on Earth hoped that over time, you know, the wind storms would clear some of that dust off and that they could communicate with Opportunity again. But for whatever reason, that just never happened.
So prior to Opportunity and its companion rover Spirit, how much did we really know about Mars?
Well, NASA had been successfully landing on Mars since the 1970s with landers primarily that didn't rove around. And so, you know, we had some basic ideas that, you know, the world was obviously dry and dusty now, but there were some tantalizing clues in the past that had been almost Earth-like, and this was maybe, you know, 4 billion years ago, but a long time ago, where water would have been on the surface, and there would have been, you know, much, much greener planet. And so we had an idea that that was what had happened, but Spirit and Opportunity were really the rovers that began to help us tell that story. You know, how did Mars, you know, lose its atmosphere? What were conditions really like? How long, you know, was water on the surface of Mars? And, you know, maybe, you know, could there have been life at that time? And so they helped tell us that story. We certainly don't have all the answers yet, but they set us on that path.
Talking with Eric Berger. He is senior space editor at Ars Technica. We're talking about the end of the Opportunity mission and what is next for exploring on Mars. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Eric, what did we learn then from Opportunity's images about the landscape of Mars and what we had thought about and what really the landscape looked like?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we learned a lot about Earth from Mars. We learned about kind of the geology of the red planet and how it formed, and that helped provide some answers about how, you know, how our own world may have looked, you know, a long time ago. And frankly, we learned about ourselves. These rovers really captivated the public's attention because, you know, Spirit lasted almost 10 years, and now Opportunity lasted 15 years, and they really, you know, we really humanized them because they were sort of these intrepid explorers on a distant world, you know, hopefully serving as the robotic precursors for eventual, you know, humans. And sort of the discoveries of these rovers, the vistas they sent, the idea that they were, you know, over there driving for 20 or 30 miles across another world kind of whetted the appetite, certainly of NASA and people who like space, to eventually send humans there.
How difficult is it to land a rover on Mars?
It's extremely difficult. The fact is no other country other than the United States has successfully soft-landed a spacecraft on that world. Russia has tried almost 10 times, and their best effort was to have a spacecraft land on Mars and send back a signal, and it survived about 20 seconds and then died. The fact of the matter is that NASA has landed on Mars 8 times. And it's very difficult because, you know, you need to build up a lot of energy to get from Earth to Mars in a reasonable amount of time, and then you need to slow down when you get there, and then you need to come to a, you know, soft landing on Mars. When there's no atmosphere, it's difficult because you can't really slow down as much through parachutes, so you have to use thrusters and things like that to slow down, and parachutes help, but not like they do when you're, you know, coming to Earth to slow down. So it's just very difficult to get down there, and it's obviously hard because it's so far away. You don't have any control. You kind of push the button and let it go.
So how has NASA improved on its rovers since launching Opportunity and Spirit? What are they doing there now?
Well, in 2012, you may recall Curiosity landed on Mars, and that was a much larger and more capable rover with about, you know, 8 to 10 times the scientific payload of Spirit and Opportunity. So basically those rovers showed us how to build systems that could survive on Mars for a long time, and then they were scaled up with Curiosity. And there's another rover that's a lot like Curiosity called the Mars 2020 mission that's going to launch in 2020. And the interesting thing is there is that's going to bring with it a small solar-powered helicopter that will actually be able to go up and scout around and come back and look. And other countries, too, are now, you know, looking at going to Mars. The European Space Agency, China, India, Japan all have, you know, missions to Mars, either land or to rove around or to go into orbit. To really help sort of open up the exploration. And of course, the Holy Grail is a kind of Mars sample return mission, which is where one spacecraft kind of goes along and collects samples on the surface of Mars, and then another comes along and carries us back to Earth so that they can be studied here, because you just get much better information if you can actually put the material in your lab. And you know, there's only so much science you can do from a small rover on another world.
Well, Eric, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Eric Berger is senior space editor at the technology news website Ars Technica. Coming up, we'll talk about President Trump's national emergency declaration as a means to get around Congress and build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Democrats call the move unconstitutional. What do you think? 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute, maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. We're talking about President Trump's national emergency on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Friday, the president laid out the administration's plan to free up roughly $8 billion to be put toward building a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. He declared a national emergency in a Rose Garden announcement.
We fight wars that are 6,000 miles away, wars that we should have never been in many cases, but we don't control our own border. So we're going to confront the national security crisis on our southern border, and we're going to do it one way or the other. We have to do it.
What was your reaction when you heard about the national emergency declaration? Are you pleased, concerned, or maybe turned off by the tug of war of Washington politics? We're at 800-642-1234. Send your thoughts on the emergency order to ideas@WPR.org. Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa and a faculty advisor to the University of Iowa College Republicans. He's author of Iowa Votes, Registration Demographics 1982 to 2016, and most recently, Supreme Court Agenda Setting, the Vincent Court. Tim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Well, let's talk a moment and understand the procedure set in place for this. What is the process for the executive branch to declare a national emergency?
Well, the odd thing about this is that the statute itself really doesn't specify any particular procedure. So it's probably just a matter and I'm sure it's a little bit more routine at this point. Actually, maybe routine's not the best word, but they sort of have a procedure put in place. But it's pretty much up to the president to do this in consultation with certain experts, no doubt, cabinet secretaries and things of that nature. But again, the statute really doesn't specify what constitutes a national emergency.
So this is the 1976 National Emergencies Act?
Right.
And it's pretty wide open?
It is. It basically just says the president's going to declare a national emergency, but it doesn't say how. It doesn't specify a particular process. And like I said, given the number of national emergencies that have been declared since 1976, and the number is approaching 60, I've heard 58 and 56, but something slightly less than 60, given that they probably do have a procedure in place. It's not an official one in terms of some legislative act. It's just a matter of the president saying, okay, we think this is something that's sufficiently important, of national importance, that we're going to declare an emergency and then take certain action. And that's really the key to this, is that the act itself was intended to make sure that that Congress had a say in this, that they can always overturn a national emergency through a joint resolution and so forth. But in terms of the procedure of actually declaring one, that's really left up to the executive branch.
Yeah, in terms of this action, tell us a little bit more about Congress's role here.
Well, it's kind of a combination of things. As I mentioned, that if Congress is unhappy with something that's been declared a national emergency, they can always sort of try to reverse it through a joint resolution, and that's probably not likely to happen given the split control. Democrats, of course, controlling the House, Republicans controlling the Senate. But the more important in this particular instance approach is going to be where the money has been coming from. And so the amount of money that the president is trying to free up through this declaration is coming from a couple of different sources. And Congress is control of the budget appropriations and is going to complain through lawsuits on certain aspects of this.
Well, we'll get to looking at the legal end of this in just a bit, but how does funding work for national emergencies? What do we know about what the president is and isn't allowed to do with the money he'll get?
Well, that's the funny thing, is that when you look at the list of national emergencies, at least the ones that are ongoing, and that's sort of the odd thing about this, is that you kind of get the impression that a national emergency is a very unusual kind of thing. But like I said, it's been declared almost 60 times since 1976. And right now, we have about 31 that are ongoing, that are basically renewed every year. And so as a result, you look and say, well, why do we have so many? Why are they still ongoing? Well, part of the reason for this is that they tend to be the kind of things where you're just blocking property and prohibiting certain people from engaging in certain economic activity. So it's not something that would normally affect Congress in particular, but generally the public as a whole, although every once in a while you hear something in the news about, you know, some country or some person's assets from a particular country have been frozen, and the reason why, because of ongoing war, civil discontent in some particular country or what have you. This one is unusual because it does involve particular monies that are going to be expended, and apparently the only other time that's happened was the national emergency that was declared immediately after 9/11, and that one nobody was really going to object to some monies being moved around, so to speak, to deal with the specific emergency that was going on at that time.
Yeah, we're talking with University of Iowa political scientist Tim Hagel, and he's with us as we look at the president's national emergency declaration on Friday. And you can be a part of the conversation. What challenges do you think are ahead for the debate over immigration and border security following this announcement? Are you perhaps happy that Congress averted another government shutdown? What do you think of the deal making and the outcome? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tim, White House officials say the president's actions free up a total of about $8 billion for border wall construction. Before that, the president wanted less than $6 billion from Congress for that. Do you think that there is, you know, Democrats are feeling perhaps a little bit frustrated about seeing that increase in funding for the border wall and maybe settling on a slightly lower number for that funding?
Well, I'm not so sure about that. They, of course, didn't want him to get the various figures were thrown around. $5.7 billion was one that was commonly talked about. And if it's now up around $8 billion, I don't know that that difference makes much of a difference to congressional Democrats. They didn't want him, obviously, to even have $5.7 billion, and they initially offered $1.6 billion, and it was even less than that. So anything above that $1.375 billion, which was approved in the spending deal that was passed, they're going to be unhappy about it. And so the fact that it's now closer to $8 billion, well, that just doesn't even matter.
Well, we're getting some calls and emails here. Mike in Ettrick emailed to say, in my opinion, there is no emergency at our southern border apart from the one in President Trump's mind. He says we have many more urgent crises and would prefer emergency declarations for those, including the peril of climate change. So what do we know, Tim Hagel, about how Americans feel about this declaration?
Well, you hear a lot of comments like that. Democrats talk about that particular thing and have talked about it since Trump announced his national emergency. And that's, again, part of the thing. So what is exactly a national emergency? And as I said, when you look down at the list of the ones that are ongoing, they always seem to be about asset forfeiture, not so much forfeiture, but freeing of assets and blocking property transfers, things of that nature. You might say, well, why is this a national emergency, especially when it's dealing with maybe punishing somebody from some other country because of something that's going on in their country, and how does this affect us directly? So you could always argue whether something is or isn't a national emergency. And Trump has tried to make that case for quite a while, actually, as to why it's important to build a wall. Now, of course, the big issue is always talked about is immigration, but Trump has tried to say, well, it's not just the immigration issue per se, even though that's a problem. It's something that pretty much everybody agrees has to be reformed. And of course, the difference is what exactly do you want to do about it? But Trump's tried to make that case that it's more than immigration because of the human trafficking, sex trafficking that's going on, the drugs that are coming across, potential for terrorists coming across the border too. And those are the kinds of things that he's emphasized or tried to emphasize to make the case for this being a national emergency. Immigration, of course, plays into that to a certain extent as well, although not less the national emergency part, but the part that it's a problem that needs to be solved.
Well, let's take a look at potential legal challenges. Even the president says he expects them. California is the first state that's come out already Friday saying it will sue. What is your take on the legal challenges?
Well, it's interesting, and it's not surprising. And even Trump, when he made the announcement, was kind of mocking the fact that this was going to happen. He had that little sing-songy sort of section of his talk where he says, oh, it'll get sued, and this will happen, and that'll happen. And he was basically right, though, in the sense that pretty much anything that people have been unhappy about his administration doing, they've gotten a lawsuit out of it. And it's not hard these days to find a federal district court judge that's willing to block something that the administration has done, and especially if it's in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes California. So then it goes up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's known as a fairly liberal court, and it's also a court that routinely gets overturned. Well, I shouldn't say routinely, fairly regularly gets overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. So basically the administration is expecting these challenges and expecting that it's going to go on up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the question here is what the basis is going to be for any group, whether it's a state or a particular group, as to what's the basis, what's their standing. In other words, how specifically have they been harmed? Congress should certainly have a basis for suing if they believe that the president has inappropriately used funds that they've appropriated for other purposes. But whether if a state or some other group is going to be able to claim standing that they have specifically been harmed, that's a different question.
University of Iowa political scientist Tim Hagel stays with us as we continue to dig into the debate over immigration and border security. You can join in 800-642-1234. Are you relieved we avoided another shutdown, or would you rather have seen a shutdown and no emergency declaration? What are you watching as lawmakers continue to spar over how to compromise when it comes to the southern border? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back to the conversation after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the National Emergency Declaration and Congress avoiding another partial government shutdown. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle expressed concern on the Sunday talk shows over the National Emergency Declaration to divert money to fund a border wall. Republican U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation.
I support his desire to get it done sooner rather than later. And I'm disappointed that my Democratic colleagues would not give the president the money to secure the border that they were willing to give to Bush and Obama.
What questions do you have about border security and the politics of it? What concerns do you have? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Author and Professor Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa is here taking your questions and guiding us through the ins and outs of the emergency declaration. Let's go to Tom joining us in Port Wing. Hi, Tom.
Well, good morning, Kate. I'll address two of them real quick. One, the national emergency, and second, the lawfulness of it. One, you have over 11 million people illegally in the country. You have Mexican cartels that are in all of the counties in the lower 48. You have El Chapo, who amassed over $14 billion bringing black heroin, meth, and fentanyl into the country. Okay? The second thing, whether it's lawful. You know, the speaker said that this was a lawless thing for the president to do. If you read Executive Order 11490, it's completely lawful for him to do it. And Congress has the ability in 6 months after a declaration to review it. At that time, maybe the lazy Congress people will get off their duff and start exerting their actual authority.
But all right, Tom, I want to get Tim Hagel here to respond to both of your points. Tim, that this is lawful and cartels are very dangerous.
Absolutely. And like I was saying before, that this is part of Trump's justification that he said on numerous occasions in terms of trying to stop drugs that are coming across the border. Now, the counterargument the Democrats will often indicate as well, but drugs come across in other ways, not just across the border. And that may be true, but this is certainly one way that could be stopped, according to Trump's argument. And whether it's the cartel specifically and whoever else it happens to be, that this is something that certainly is affecting a number of Americans. And that's, again, part of the basis for Trump's wanting to declare a national emergency here.
Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer from New York say that the president's action violates Congress's exclusive power of the purse. And we've been hearing a lot about the power of the purse. Tell us what they're referring to.
Well, what they're referring to is that under the Constitution, it's the Congress that says how money is to be spent. In particular, spending bills have to start in the U.S. House. Everybody knows that, learns it back in civics and in high school or wherever. And so that's basically what the concern is that Congress has said, well, look, we haven't authorized this money beyond that $1.375 billion. But the problem here, and part of the reason why the president's declared the national emergency, is that that gives him some additional powers to access certain funds for a variety of things. And one of those, and one of the ones in particular Congress is going to complain about, is the $3.6 billion that comes from military construction. That if that money has been specifically, or at least initially was specifically set aside for particular projects, Congress is going to be unhappy if it's all of a sudden used for something different, such as building some sort of physical barrier on the border. Now, apparently that can be accessed, that money can be accessed because of the declaration of a national emergency, but Congress is still not going to be happy about it, and that's where we're likely to see some good grounds for a lawsuit, and then the courts will have to sort it out.
Well, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin said on Meet the Press yesterday he's concerned about the precedent this will set.
I regret that past Congresses have given the president, any president, a lot of its, you know, the Congress's constitutional authority. It's done it on tariffs. It's done in this case. It's done in many cases. We should have three co-equal branches. Right now, the presidency is probably the most powerful, and then the courts. And Congress is really diminished.
So, Tim, what do you make of that, that Congress needs to reassert its power?
Well, it kind of gets back to what the caller was saying, is that a lot of people are unhappy that Congress really hasn't acted. Even when you have a situation where you have both chambers of Congress, the U.S. House and the Senate, controlled by the same party, you often see that they don't get a lot done sometimes. And especially the situation now where you've got split control, that it pretty much stymies any action, and that leaves a lot of leeway for the president. And we saw this in the Obama administration. He famously said that he's got a pen and a phone when Congress control was split and nothing was really getting through. He's going to take it upon himself to do certain things. Republicans complained at the time, but now we're back in the same situation with a different party in the White House. And so to some extent, again, Congress does need to reassert itself and make itself a co-equal branch of government and not cede too much authority to the presidency. But again, that's been happening for a very long time, mainly because Congress has had so much difficulty in terms of getting anything done. In terms of that precedent that Senator Johnson was talking about, you've also got the situation where the concern, and this is kind of mentioned previously, where the next president could just as easily declare a national emergency on climate change, on gun control, on whatever it happens to be. And that's true, and that's something that probably could happen and maybe will happen, and whatever Congress is in place at that time will have to deal with whatever the president decides to do along those lines.
It seems that Republican U.S. Senator from Florida, Marco Rubio, had that apprehension. He released a statement that he agrees border security is a national emergency, but a future president could use this exact same tactic to impose the Green New Deal. Is Rubio right to question the method here?
He is, to a certain extent, although I did see one commentator said, well, the problem here isn't so much what the president wants to do, but the method he's chosen to do it, the idea of declaring a national emergency. Whereas, again, President Obama famously said, well, look, I have a pen and a phone. He didn't even bother to declare a national emergency to do whatever it was that he wanted to do at that particular time. So, again, the president has a lot of power these days. It just happened that President Trump decided, okay, this is the way to go, probably in part because he needed to have monies available to construct the physical barrier at one point or another, whether it was that $3.6 billion in military construction or the asset forfeiture money or whatever it happens to be, that he needed that declaration. And so that's the particular method. But again, Senator Rubio is right, and the other Republican senators are expressing concerns along these lines too. And we'll just have to wait and see who that next president is. And then, of course, which party has control of Congress, because as the caller indicated, that Congress at a certain point gets to review any kind of national declaration. And so sort of opened a new door here.
Talking with Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa as we consider the policy and the politics surrounding the declaration of a national emergency on the border as declared by President Trump Friday. And we want to hear from you on this. What are you watching for when it comes to what's next after the emergency declaration? What has surprised you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. Tim, let's turn to the politics of this. Is this a win for the president among his base?
Well, it is to a certain extent that the base has been very concerned for a very long time about border security, immigration aspects, but again, now with the emphasis on drugs and the opioid crisis that's occurring, that this has entered people's consciousness a little bit more than it had been previously. The human trafficking aspect wasn't of particular high profile unless there was some particular story that made the news, but it's all part of the package of trying to increase border security. And especially for the older members of Trump's base, or Republicans or conservatives more generally, they remember back in Ronald Reagan's time when the deal was is that we'd increase border security and give amnesty to people that were here illegally at that time. Well, the problem was is that the amnesty was given and the security wasn't. And so it's kind of a fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And so right now the base wants some sort of increased security, a wall along with whatever else is necessary, increased personnel, drones, electronic surveillance, whatever it happens to be. But they definitely want something, and that sort of has taken the form of some wall or fence or whatever you want to call it. And that's what they want. And they really don't care so much about who pays for it. And, if, you know, Trump famously talked in his rallies and so forth that Mexico is going to pay for it. But they don't really care too much about that. It's more a matter of having some sort of border security, then deal with the people that are here illegally, whether it's people that just came across or people that were brought over as children, the so-called dreamers. I think that a lot of conservatives would be happy to grant amnesty to particularly them, but to deal with something to allow others to stay here as well, provided we don't face this problem again like we did in the 80s when Reagan did it, and then the border security just wasn't there.
Well, what about the optics here? What do U.S. senators and representatives have to consider when they're weighing this and looking at this declaration? They could perhaps face political ramifications or maybe even opportunities from this.
Oh, absolutely. And again, it's unfortunate, but it's the reality that we face these days where it's an issue that's highly political. Democrats are, of course, focusing on more the immigration side of things. That's why they don't see it as a national emergency in the same way that the administration does, in terms of trying to focus a little bit more on whether it's the drugs or the human trafficking aspects to it, and then immigration more generally. So that's basically the back and forth that you have. So it's really a problem potentially for those members of Congress, the House and the Senate, who are in sort of states that maybe are contrary to what their party interests are. So in other words, if you're a Republican senator in a blue state or a Democratic senator in a red state kind of a thing, or representative or what have you, that, you know, what's the population looking at? But again, a lot of times the people in general don't care. The bases are going to get fired up. Democratic base very fired up about this. Republican base very fired up. But you have that large group of people that are in the middle that are just trying to live their daily lives and maybe aren't caring quite so much about the inside baseball, so to speak, aspects of this politics. And they can sort of understand that, well, look, we do need to care about border security for a variety of reasons, whether it's the drugs and the trafficking or just in general immigration and whatever's going on there. But they see other problems. And again, the focus is on the economy and making sure jobs are plentiful.
And let's pause right there with political scientist Tim Hagel, who stays with us. We will be back in a minute, maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the National Emergency Declaration and Congress averting another shutdown. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lawmakers are weighing what this National Emergency Declaration means for their authority. Wisconsin's Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson chairs the Senate Homeland Security Committee.
I'm going to take a look at the case the president makes. And I'm also going to take a look at how quickly this money is actually going to be spent versus what he's going to use. If he's not going to be spending it this fiscal year, or very early in the next fiscal year, I would have my doubts. So again, I'm going to take a look at it, and I'll decide when I actually have to vote on it.
What are you watching moving forward? What do you want to see from the president? What about Congress? Call in to share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. University of Iowa political scientist Tim Hagel is with us as we continue our dive into the politics and the policy surrounding President Trump's recent national emergency declaration. So, Tim, this declaration overshadowed the fact that the bipartisan spending bill and border security compromise happened in Congress and it was presented to the president. So what do you make of those negotiations and how we landed at a compromise there?
Well, the big sticking point that we had, what caused us to end up in a big shutdown for extended period of time, really had little to do with the spending over most of the departments. It had to do with spending over a wall. How much was it going to be? Was it going to be that $5.7 billion, or was it going to be something much less than that? And that's what it turned out to be, much less than that. And, of course, the reason that the Republicans and the Trump administration went along with that was because they had in mind the plan, which had been just sort of hinted at previously, to declare a national emergency and free up some funds that way, which ultimately that's what happened. So in some sense, it's unfortunate because you do like to see some bipartisan activity that the parties can come together, especially in spending bills, which have often been held up for, the last decade or so. This is a fairly common occurrence where you have to have what are called continuing resolutions, CRs, rather than actual spending bills. Because, of course, as we said before, Congress is the one that has to appropriate this money. And it would be a good thing, something you could highlight. Well, look, they came together on this, but instead the fight is and was over the amount of money that was going to be spent for some sort of physical barrier. And so basically, as I said, the Trump administration went along with the lower number, knowing that they were going to declare a national emergency.
Well, so we avoided another shutdown, but we know how the president has fared in this by declaring this national emergency and what impact it might have in terms of favorability of Congress.
Well, right now, neither one of them is all that well-regarded in Congress, usually much less than even the president. The president's poll numbers have usually been fairly low relative to other presidents. They go up and down a little bit, and undoubtedly his base has been happy that, we didn't get the money for a larger amount of money for the wall, but, okay, this is a way to do it. Now, whether they're going to be happy about this, if this were suggesting before the next president declares a national emergency on climate change or adopts the Green New Deal or what have you, then perhaps that won't be as happy at that particular time. But at least right now, this is something that, as we were saying before, that the president and members of Congress are going to have to deal with moving forward, because, of course, it's still not going to end, that we've got the lawsuits to contend with, and that'll take some time. And as your senator was saying, that we'll see when is this money going to be spent. It's not going to be spent immediately. And so this will be one of those sort of ongoing issues as we see this thing work its way through the courts before Trump actually is able to spend any of this money. And then maybe in the future, Congress would be willing to appropriate a little bit more. Although at this point, I think everybody's heels are dug in.
Well, let's go to Bill joining us from Ashland. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. I want to ask this question. I want to emphasize that I'm referring to illegal immigrants, of course, but what is being proposed to hold those who hire illegal immigrants accountable and to eliminate, and one of the things that I keep hearing is about people coming in, illegal immigrants who are getting social benefits that really should be reserved for American citizens.
All right, so Bill is looking at what onus is on businesses here as they hire undocumented immigrants. Tim Hagel?
Well, there are certain laws that are in place that prevent that, and sometimes it varies from state to state. There are federal laws in place, too, although some of those have been resisted by Democrats in trying to shore up those kinds of things. So it's sort of an open question on that aspect right now. As far as the social services, this is another argument that the administration has used, is that this costs a lot of money for states to provide these services, but the services can't be denied to people just because, even if they're here illegally, you can't simply say, all right, we're not going to give you whatever it happens to be the service. And one area where this comes up that I heard people talking about, say, yesterday, was in education, that if people, even if they're here illegally, that they are basically have access to public education, which, of course, puts a greater burden on the schools and school districts in various ways, higher class sizes, and then can hire more teachers as a result of that, or staff members. And so there are financial burdens that are put on areas that maybe have a higher concentration of illegal immigration. And so that's one reason that people make this an issue and say this is why we have to deal with this problem. But again, there is a difference of opinion as what needs to be done at any particular point in time.
Let's bring in Ivy now, joining us from Evansville. Hi, Ivy.
Hi. Having followed this issue for a long time and understanding how the wall became part of Donald Trump's mantra, it was simply a way to rile his base, and it really is a metaphor for refusing to allow more people of color into the country. I mean, he shut down the government, meanwhile putting our shorelines at risk. Our borders there. Why isn't he concerned about Canada? You know, I mean, there's a way people could get in. And it really upsets me because there's so many reasons why you wouldn't want a wall. And the Republicans, I just think, are really being hypocritical, because one of their big things was private property. And here they are. They're going to plow through people's homes and ranches and our national wildlife refuges and a butterfly preserve. And it just alarms me. And the other thing is, I want to know who's getting the money for keeping these beds. Is there the private contractors? Are they his friends?
Okay, Ivy, I want to pause here so Tim Hagel can respond. Tim, go ahead.
Well, a couple of things there. One is as far as the northern border, Canada, that isn't where the focus has been. Although, as people will point out, that was one area where a person who was planning a terrorist attack was stopped at the northern border, Canadian border, in by the state of Washington. And so there certainly is a potential problem there, but that's not where the drugs are coming across. That's not where the human trafficking is. That's not where the illegal immigration is. So that's why you don't have that focus on the Canadian border. As far as the assets and so forth, caller is right in the sense that for two aspects. One is the portion of the money dealing with asset forfeiture, that Republicans have been concerned about asset forfeiture long before it became an issue regarding some physical barrier. And to the extent that this physical barrier is going to be built, that there's concerns, as the caller was indicating, about eminent domain, and that basically where is this going to be built, and is it going to require private property be taken for government use, which is the eminent domain thing. And yeah, Republicans have been concerned about this as well. And so those are issues that have to be worked out. And I suspect that the wall or the physical barrier would be built in areas that would be sort of an easy build. In other words, the government already owns this land in one way or another before you get to the areas where it's a problem. On the other hand, these ranchers and folks down in the border have also been complaining that if there isn't any kind of a barrier there, that people have been coming across and it's been causing them problems. So I think they might be somewhat open to the idea of having some of their property used for a barrier of some sort.
Tim, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa and a faculty advisor to the University of Iowa College Republicans. He's the author of Iowa Votes, Registration Demographics 1982 to 2016, and most recently, Supreme Court Agenda Setting, the Vinson Court. The conversation doesn't stop here. Continue to share your thoughts by mentioning WPR Mornings on Twitter. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.